Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And we're going to talk about, we're actually going to rehash some stuff.
yes, we are. And we're also going to talk some trailers because it's almost summer movie season. And what does that mean? That means more new trailers. Yeah, we've got a couple of other, like, I got some news items. Why don't we start off with the thing that you sent me, which was kind of interesting. And I kind of want to know your take on it, but also, like, it's a very WTF like news item, which is Kevin Smith signed a deal to have an Archie team up with Jay and Silent Bob. And all I had to that's just like a what the hell? You're a dude on the ground floor with all things Kevin Smith. I mean, I know my opinion. I'm actually highly interested in this because it's almost like. It's putting Jay and Silent Bob into the John Hughes universe, almost like. It's like, what? Like, these are two very different.
Yeah, that Dave, he's kind of wanted to exist in that space for a very long time. I mean, there are large parts of his early work. I mean... Jay and Silent Bob themselves wind up where they are at the beginning of Dogma because they're going to search for what they don't know is a fictional town in Illinois.
where all the John Hughes films take place, which is, you know, is kind of hilarious to think that a fantasy movie like Dogma is like does this kind of double entendre to which I do have to say I cannot wait for them to bring out the 4K this year because the restoration is done. I'm wondering when they're gonna show it. It's been so long since I've seen the film, like Dogma, it's so long, like it's literally been a decade. So I'm kind of excited, like I'm gonna hold off because I don't want to see an inferior version, but that like I know that they've done, like, I mean, I read the hilarious Archie versus Predator kind of comic, but, like, is it going to be that kind of take, that kind of, like...
Here's my big thing. Mm-hmm. I think this will be fun. He's writing it'll be crude, for sure. But in a post-Riverdale world, this almost seems like a day late and a dollar short, but it's also the kind of thing that can kind of only exist in a post Riverdale world. Like you have to have proven that you can do this kind of like bizarre take, even though like there's been, like you said, Predator Archie, Punisher Archie. There's been some weird Archie takes prior to Riverdale, but nothing quite so crass. And Riverdale definitely, it wasn't like crude humor, but it definitely walked that, like, oh, this is almost too adult for what the material even is. So it'll be fun, it'll be fine. I think that this will be a better Kevin, like, if you're wanting to read some of Kevin Smith's comic work, it's going to be better than the stuff he's been putting out under his own label, I think, which started out really, really promising, and his, like, Quick Stops series, like, filling in, like, little stories from the View Askewniverse, has quickly turned into just nonsense. Like, volume one is pretty fun. Volume two is not great. And volume three is supposedly coming soon, but after volume two, I have very little hope for it at all. Okay. I'm way more interested in what he's doing with this. And I mean, apparently there's a new Jay and Silent Bob movie. Like, script is in the can. They're supposed to film sometime this year, I think. You know, it's kind of weird to see, like, he and Quentin kind of started in the same, not the exact same time, but like in that same era.
Yeah.
And Quentin has not been as prolific, even though it's weird to say Kevin Smith's been prolific, and is very much winding down his career by his own admission. And Kevin Smith just keeps finding ways to try to reinvent his. But, I mean, the best thing he ever did was understand that he's never going to sell himself to a larger audience. He's just going to keep selling himself to the same people that already like his shit. So, which I am one of. So,
yeah, no. And, you know, he kind of is the model for micro transactions and like what I think is the future of filmmaking. Like, to be quite honest, like when we look back, like, yeah, Quentin will have an imprint on cinema, capital C, but I feel like the future, I feel like, is going to be what all the things that Kevin Smith has done with the forward thinking, with the way that he, he did his own distribution on films. His college tours, like all of this, the kind of circus natured kind of like the circus themed, like, you know, selling of himself. Like, I mean, if he doesn't exist, I don't know if Joe Rogan exists, which I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing right now at this point, but, it's to say that like podcasters weren't podcasters with a capital P until he started kind of taking it on and kind of like, you know, like he has more fingers in forward thinking technology and forward thinking like finance.
Well, he doesn't really podcast anymore. Like he has
his universe
podcasting that he does. But at one point in time, I mean, he had his own network. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess he kind of still does. And it was like a big, huge focus that he put all his energy into. And then
a lot of money off of.
Yeah. And like, then pivoting to like other things.
Yeah. Other
podcasting became this, like, I say this as we're recording a podcast that, you know, probably, you know, nobody listens to compared to any, you know, of the majors out there. But as podcasting kind of just became overwhelming, he kind of sort of pivoted out of it and just doesn't do as much. I mean, he was putting out, you know, 6-7 podcasts a week in different formats and, you know, and now it's, yeah, I mean, I think he does something with his daughter once a week, and he and Ralph Garman still do Hollywood Babylon, but it's now a monthly show. They just get together once a month. You know, it's just kind of funny how he keeps, you know, dipping in and out of things and reinventing himself more or less, or, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people find that just like ridiculous and look at it as like, oh, he's just constantly trying to find something to make himself relevant, to which I would say, I don't know how that makes him any different from most of the other people on this planet. He's just doing it in a more public format because he can. So, you know, he screams into the void and there are people in the void listening. We do it and it's just like the 7 people we know are like, yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But like, yeah, like the whole thing is that like, I don't ever take him like I don't always, I don't never, I don't take him for granted like many people do. Like, he has an audience, and that audience has been able to finance his life for the last 35 years. Like, I mean, that's how long, like you said, like, you know, you used Quentin, like, you know, him, Quentin, Rodriguez, Linklater, they all came up at the same time, and they're all making livings, but they're all wildly different, right?
Yeah.
Like, did you see the Rodriguez thing where he's opening his own weird studio where you could pitch ideas, and he'll, like, it's like this weird kind of, like crowdsourcing, like, movie studio where he's got like he's financing 10 films all at about $1 million, and he's going to direct one of them. And it's just like, but it's like all of these kinds of crowdsourcing things are like things that either people are diving into or they're just kind of completely staying away from. Like, you know, yeah. like him and Rodriguez are like those kinds of guys that are always forward thinking, but then, like, you know, you look at Quentin and Linklater. I mean, Linklater is going to be, he's going to be like, I mean, he's actually filming Sondheim's Along the Way We Go, Merrily Along the Way We Go, which, if anybody's ever seen that Sondheim musical, it takes place over 40 years, and he has a cast that he's filming once every 10 years, because it takes place once every 10 years, like the sections of the musical. So he's going to be filmmaking until he dies. Like, it's just like, that's the way that Linklater, and he's got it so that he has things that people, you know, set up. Quentin the same way. Like, Quentin's gonna end his career supposedly, right? I don't believe it. I think he'll be 10 and out, and then 10 years later he's gonna come back. I mean, they already said that his first thing to do once he figures out what the number 10 is to go back with Leo and do Bounty Law from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, is to actually do like the weird Lightyear kind of thing. Like, you know, like, it didn't work for Lightyear, but it might work for Bounty Law. Yeah. It's like Leo DiCaprio playing an actor, playing a part in an old 50s TV series. And we already know, like, he's going to get a ton of people to be in it. But, like, the thing is, Quentin's going to be writing books. Like, it's not going to be the end. I don't even think he's going to
fit. Well, he was doing it before Smith was doing it. But, you know, them getting into the theater game and doing this kind of niche screenings for things, you know. Smith does his own, a lot of his own work, but he's been able to get, you know, it's kind of a dog and pony show, you know, like, hey, we're going to screen this movie, because he knows people and he's fairly affable. It's like, oh, we've got, this actor from this movie, and we're going to do a Q&A, and it's a whole event. And, you know, he's keeping a very small theater alive by doing that. And Quentin's got, what's the theater that he's?
The New Beverly.
Yeah, the New Beverly.
The New Beverly. And then he also has another one. He also has another one that he just took over. I can't think of the name off the top of my head of what it is. But he also took – he has two theaters now that he programs. But the other one, the Vista – it's the Vista. But the other one, the Vista, it does first-run movies. Just recently they're having the Soderbergh movie. But it's only 35, which is a weird concept to me. So Soderbergh only shoots on digital, but – Black Bag is going to be playing there in 35, so they're transferring it to 35.
Took a digital, and
yeah,
I mean, that I get it, but like, that also seems like a lot of money to transfer something you shot digitally to 35mm to screen it. What, in a dozen places? I mean,
only one place, the Vista. Like, he's only like, it's only it. Like, the deal is, I feel like, I think is...
Well, yeah, there's probably only one print, right?
So. Yeah, but here, like, or, like, the studio prints out a couple... Well, okay, so, like, here's the dirty secret that people don't know, is that most digital movies get printed onto 35 and then get stored in cold storage in, like, three different places. One's in Salt Lake City, There's a salt mine. That's why it's called Salt Lake City, not because the lake is salt, but it's also because there's a huge salt lake reservoir. And it's mainly where film is collected. And basically all the movie studios all do the same thing, which is their digital films, because they know that all of the formats are going to change and it's going to be like nonsensical bullshit. They still print digital films onto 35 and they store them in their salt mines to make sure that they have a copy of them, because 35 is forever, or physical thing is forever. All you need is a light source and you can show it, right? Like, yeah. Isn't that wild? That is wild. Like,
Warner Brothers had to do a lot of mea culpa this week, and not very well, because of turns out that not only are most if not all of the DVDs printed between 2006 and 2010, just not good anymore. Disc rot, totally. Most of those, or a lot of those, can't be reissued because of rights and whatnot. And their solution is just to shoulder shrug. Okay, sorry, guys.
What? Sorry. Our bad. Yep. Yeah. That's why, it's so wild to think that, a format, and they knew, the weirdest part is that Laserdisc had the same problem, and now DVD, they knew about this. They actually knew about this. And the reason why it happened was because they used defective materials because they wanted to save money. Now, here's the thing is that thankfully, Blu-ray is not Blu-ray. One of the things that Sony solved was the rot issue, because of the format that they print on. It's not a clear format. It's literally the reason why it's called blue is Blu-ray is because there's blue laser, but it's also printed on a format that's not a clear, transparent format. It's essentially, so it doesn't have that problem. The same with 4K. At least that's what we've been told by Sony. But DVDs, I guess inferior materials propagated this issue, and gotta love Warner Brothers. They continue to do stupid things. Like you said, there's a lot of stuff that's just not going to be printed. They can't reprint it anymore because they don't have the rights to it, or music right issues have lapsed and it's too expensive for them. So they'll never be able to do those printings again for some of those DVDs.
Yeah.
And it's okay. Well, I guess it just goes into your vaults, right? That's where it is. It's in your vaults and it'll stay in your vaults and we won't be able to see it. Okay. Well, that's cool. Until the rights people die and you can kind of re-release it. But even then, it's wild. I mean, Warner Bros. Is a fucking wild-ass place anyways. I mean, they're letting Catch Up Entertainment release a fucking Looney Tunes film. A Looney Tunes film. How is it that we are living in a world where I've not seen one ad for this Looney Tunes film, and everybody that has seen it that I know, or people that are, my friends that are critics,
says it's good.
It's great. And it's fucking dying on the goddamn vine, because Ketchum Entertainment got it for a buck and they don't know what to do with it, because it's not a Terrifier movie. It's not an Art the Clown movie. They don't know how to fucking sell that. It's just
I finally saw the trailer and I was just that looks fun. I mean, honestly, if coming up Friday, if my weekend wasn't going to be spent traveling, you had talked about we just said it, what's the other movie? And which I'm that looks fun, but then I saw the Looney Tunes trailer, and what my response probably would have been was I think I'm gonna go see Looney Tunes because it looks fun.
Yeah,
and early reviews are hey, this actually is great. People should go see this.
Yep.
I mean, it's just wild.
Yeah, it's wild. Like how do you like I can only imagine like I can only imagine Joe Dante is literally sitting there yelling into the void at the disgust like he has for these people that are just like that's okay, so that's two goddamn Looney Tunes movies that we are like that literally WB didn't know what to do with. One, they've just shuttered.
Nobody will ever see it.
We'll be like, you know what's going to happen? I already know. Like, you and I both already know what's going to happen. It's going to magically end up on. I'm still waiting for Batgirl to end up on the gray web.
Yeah, I can only hope, you know.
It will. I guarantee you.
In a world where we can get Roger Corman's Fantastic Four movie, like, I hope somewhere there's a print of that movie on somebody's hard drive and they're just like sitting on it, like waiting and figuring out how to get it out there. Like, yeah. Both of those movies. I mean, there have been a lot of movies that have gotten shelved that we'll never really see any bits and parts of, but
for good reason, too.
Yeah, you know. But man, like those are two that it's just like, yeah, but I get the tax write-off thing, but like when they try to throw like damaging the brand or something up there, and I'm like, you do more damage to the brand than like Disney did that with the Star Wars show. That the Robot Chicken guys. Well, no, that's the live-action one that they never really filmed anything for. They just had scripts for. But they had an animated show from the Robot Chicken guys that Seth Green says they had 2 seasons worth of episodes, I think.
Yep.
And they just canned it. They were like, no, we're not going to put this out there. It's damaging to the brand. And nothing has been more damaging to the Star Wars brand outside of Star Wars. Like, you couldn't possibly damage this brand anymore. So I would like to see that show, please.
So. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's like, you do realize you released The Rise of Skywalker, right? You do realize you released The Force Awakens, right? Like movies that, like, are all about, like, just, like, oh, who's the best person who's the hottest director we can, oh, J.J. Abrams! And, like, basically remake Star Wars, like, for the worse. Like, it's one of those things that I'm just like, yeah. And then, you know, Rick McCallum this week going off on an Indiana Jones podcast. Like, have you listened to the podcast? Because I
haven't listened to it, but I saw some quotes.
Oh, and, man.
Yeah, McCallum talking about the live action show and like that. That was something.
Oh, man. You could tell that. Like, when you hear him on the show, it's like Quincy Jones. When Quincy Jones decided, like, oh, yeah. I'm Quincy Jones. I don't give a fuck. Rolling Stones, you want to interview me? I will give you all the shade. I will tell you all the bullshit. Or Cat Williams. It's funny how, like, Cat, like, said all that shit, and everybody, like, wanted to, like, you know, say, oh, you're full of shit, you're crazy. And then all of a sudden, all this shit started coming out, and the repercussions of all the shit that he said about Diddy and everybody all of a sudden started coming out. It's like, oh, maybe he isn't so crazy. Like, the same thing with Rick McCallum. I feel like he's like, I've got zero fucks to give. I got paid. I don't have an NDA like George does. I'm going to fucking say exactly what I thought and probably what George thought, which is like, we had 60 episodes of content. Like, that's the thing that's fucking wild to me, is that they had 60 scripts. That's like, if you do it Game of Thrones style, because it's $40 million an episode, that's 12 episodes, right? That's 5 seasons of a TV show. And like, I just love that Disney was like, nah, we're good, we're just gonna
Here's the thing. It was $40 million an episode when they were proposing filming it.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be $40 million an episode now.
Oh no, it would probably be what Lord of the Rings is, which is more like 100 million an episode.
I mean, but with the volume, do you think it would be that much?
So we've heard the rumors about how much Mando cost, like the last season of Mando cost, and that was very volume heavy, and that was still like hovering around 75 million an episode. Okay. So it's all like, you know what it is? It's all like what we talk. Okay, like we're going to get into a trailer that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. That's all about render time. Like I talked to you about, like, you know, it's all render time. Like that's what Cameron, like the gift that Cameron gave me was, it's not, it has nothing to do with any, like with your artists.
Everybody wants, like everybody gets, even haters, lovers alike want to point the Avatar and be like, why the hell is it taking so long? Well, do you want it to look like it looks? Because that's how long it takes.
Rendering time. That's what it is. And so, like, the more you render, the more it costs. Because like he's always said, it's simple mathematics. It doesn't change the amount of time, like the amount per second, the cost per minute to render is the same whether you go 1 year or 3 years. But if you can wait out 3 years and you can amass that cost, you're going to get the level that we get in Avatar.
Because it's the good, fast, cheap rule, right?
Yep, exactly.
You can have two of these things. It can be good and it can be cheaper, but it won't be very fast. It can be good and it can be fast, but it ain't going to be cheap. It can be cheap and it can be fast, and it will not be very good.
Exactly. And I feel like that's like the best way to like lead into, unless we have other things to talk about, but I feel like the trailers, and specifically one trailer, because we've talked about it a lot, and like we were kind of worried about, I mean, like, let's get into it. Like, we were worried about Lilo and Stitch because
we haven't seen anything. Like, we've seen some very, very brief, like there was the Super Bowl thing where Stitch like takes over the Super Bowl. That was pretty cute. There was like the teaser where it's just him like rolling around on the white screen. And beyond that, we really haven't had anything for a movie that comes out in almost exactly 2 months.
Yep, May.
60 May. Days from now.
Yep. It's literally like it's a Memorial Day weekend. It opens up. So we're literally 2.5 months away, but we finally got our answer. One, like we kind of talked about it, which is that I'm pretty sure it's the rendering, because like How to Train Your Dragon, like Stitch, like it's all dependent on Stitch, right? Like if you don't get Stitch right, it doesn't work. And yeah. I'm going to say from this trailer, man, they look like they got it right. Like he looks so, like all the effects looks really good. Like really good. I don't know. What was your thought?
What we saw, I agree. Looks absolutely great. I think they've got the right look for Stitch. It's not quite it's weird because How to Train Your Dragon, Toothless looks almost exactly like he does in the animated film.
Yes.
And Stitch does not look exactly like he does. He has he looks more like an animal and less like, you know.
It's the fur. He looks like a feral dog. Literally like. Like, it's weird because I know that they've always called him a cat, but in this trailer, they changed it to a dog, but he really does feel like a dog in the trailer. You can see, like, the rough, like, not even skin. It's like, I mean, we've always known it's hair, but it's the Disney version of hair, right? Like, it's a mame, and it's not, like, because they can't draw it exactly, but here, it's like you can see all the hair, but it's all clumped together. I mean, it literally looks like exactly what you would expect a Stitch to look like, because he's kind of grimy, right? Like a dog that's been playing in the grass for a couple of based too long.
Yeah. And it works. It absolutely works. Much like the How to Train Your Dragon trailer, what excites me is seeing the trailer and not feeling like, oh, this is going to be a massive disappointment. Worst case, just like How to Train Your Dragon, I go see it and be like, okay, well, I mean, this, you just made the movie, but with live action, and it's great, but like, it doesn't elicit anything new because I've seen this.
Yeah.
And that's not the worst thing. Like, it could be so much worse. So that's fine. Like, the trailer, much like kind of How to Train Your Dragon, I wouldn't say it got me super excited for getting to see this year. What it did was not make me feel like I'm going to hate this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like the little girl they got, perfect. Like, the moments that she, like the, it's not the funny moments that I wanted them to sell. It's the Ohana Means Family. Mm-hmm. And damn, I'm going to get all choked up about it because, like, that's what that movie's about, right? It's like, it's about, it's like, you know, it's like any, like, it's How to Train Your Dragon. Like, the most important part about Stitch, it, like, in that movie, like, in the movie, Lilo and Stitch, the first one, it's like this weird kind of like convex of like punk rock, like anti-authoritarian, like weirdness with like bad guyness, but it's also about like this little thing finding a family, right? And they get it right. Like that moment where she kisses him, it's like, oh dude, this is not gonna be, this is gonna, like, if they get it right, like How to Train Your Dragon, right?
Yeah.
It's gonna be one of those things where it's gonna connect with everybody. And that's my hope.
Is anybody having a, possibly, we'll see in a couple of months, but if this goes well and How to Train Your Dragon goes well,
yeah.
Is anybody having a better year than Chris Sanders? Coming off, nope. Like, not a win, but Wild Robot gets nominated for Best Animated Picture. Mm-hmm. His two most well-known, beloved animated films are getting translated into live action.
Which he's directing.
Yeah.
The other one he's...
Well, no, Dean DeBlois is directing How to Train Your Dragon.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. His co-director.
Yeah.
But he's still playing the voice of
he's Stitch. Doing Stitch. Yeah, he always does Stitch.
And what I understood, he's doing the mocap for Stitch.
Okay.
Like he did the mocap for Stitch, which is very interesting to me. It's like, okay, so how did you do that? Definitely not on set, but at least like you know, the moments.
Well, you know, like, what? We can throw Dean DeBlois in there too, because like, I mean, he was not part of Wild Robot, right? But
no.
I mean, come on, man. Like, in a month of each other, Lilo and Stitch and live action Lilo and Stitch and live action How to Train Your Dragon, and you're directing the live action How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah.
Nobody's gonna, if all this goes well, nobody's gonna have a better year than those two dudes, man.
No. Like the guys who kind of, in a weird way, kind of like at the heart and soul of what animation is, kind of saved it from like the crassness. Because I mean, if we think about it, like in the like decade where they were working, from the moment that Lilo and Stitch came out to the moment that the first How to Train Your Dragon came out, like, they were working in that kind of thing of like the way that Bambi and Dumbo are. It's like, we can still make entertaining movies, but we have forgotten the heart and soul of what, like, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Shrek, right? But it doesn't have the same sort of, like, it hits you so hard in the heart that you kind of like, you're left breathless. Like, that's the only way I can describe it. The way that, like, you know, like when it hits hard. And they know that, and they know how to do that. And so like, for that decade, and then them to have that pay off this year, if, and especially if that kind of still continues on, and they're able to like it's, you know, it's all well and good to make like a translation, but if you can connect emotionally with everybody, you know, that's the trick, right? Because E.T. doesn't, like, you know, E.T.'s a goddamn, like he's a rubber doll, but somehow, like, the magic trick of that show, the magic trick of that movie is Spielberg found a way to, like, hit you in the heart so hard that, like, even parents were like, oh! And that's all you kind of want is, like, the best case scenario is that. The worst case scenario is that it's just a shot for shot remake and it doesn't have it, which I don't think that that's the case. I think these guys and their respective studios, DreamWorks, Universal, and Disney, know what these two things mean to people, but also what it means at this point in like theatrical releases. Like, you need to deliver. Like, that's all there is to it, right? Like, if Wicked showed us anything, it's not just the respect, but you've got to pull it off with a lot of style. And, yes, you know, I'm going to say the same thing that I said with How to Train Your Dragon. I don't need to see anything else. I don't want to see anything else, actually. Like, I've seen what I needed to see. I'm good. I'll go in the rest of the time blind to it. I'm going to skip the trailers, and that'll be that. And I'll like, you know, we'll come out the other end. Memorial Day weekend to see if it delivers.
We'll see. Yeah, and they've got the right director too. Yeah. I think. I mean, he seems to really, really do it. Like, he understands the need for the heart of this stuff. That's Dean Fleischer Camp, who has done a lot, but like Marcel, the show which she's on, is his big that's you hang your hat on. And you know, I all you gotta do is watch the trailer for Marcel and be like, oh yeah, this was the right guy for this kind of thing. But yeah, like Dean DeBlois but Chris Sanders specifically for Lilo and Stitch. Like, I'm so excited for these guys. And it just, my hope for How to Train Your Dragon, even though we don't have anything new for that, is that it's big because Dean DeBlois is also attached to a Micronauts movie.
Yes, he is.
Which is really, really exciting. If they can get that off the ground. But you know, we'll see. If these movies tank, it's not going to be good for any of these people, but I don't know. I don't feel like they will. I feel like at worst, there's not going to be the $1 billion hits that kind of Disney and DreamWorks are hoping for. It'll just be like, no, that's really, really good, guys, but we've already seen this.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, this is a gamble, and I hope the gamble pays off. Like, that's the only thing that you can hope for, is that, like, you know, that everything connects, and it kind of looks like it is. I mean, that's my thing. So
I think it's going to be really funny if Tom Cruise gets trounced again in Mission Impossible by something he didn't see coming.
Well, I feel like at this point, like, it.
And also that Hannah Waddingham is in both of these movies.
Yeah, she is.
She's in The Final Reckoning and Lilo and Stitch, and they are both premiering in theaters May 23rd. She is going to make so much money on May 23rd. Like, she's going to be the queen of the box office if those two movies launch big. Because, I mean, it's it's good counter programming too, but I mean, Tom Cruise kind of played chicken with
Barbieheimer.
Yeah, and it did not work out for him.
Nope.
Because both of those movies decimated Mission Impossible. Like, it's where you think like, oh, we'll spoil each other, and that's not what happened at all.
No, it's not. It really isn't. I almost wonder if they're they'll blink and move, because
it's awful late to move. And where do you move to? Like, do you move to June?
No, you move to July. You move to July because 4th of July weekend has nothing in it. Nothing. I saw, like, there's nothing there because everybody thought that
Jurassic World's 4th of July weekend, isn't it?
That it's the week after. So you do.
Sure, I thought it was the 2nd.
Let's see here. Let's see.
Because the week after is Superman.
No, whatchamacallit is Superman is the 14th or the 15th. So let's see here. Okay, let's see here. Yeah, you're right. It's July 2nd. It's July 2nd. But yeah, Superman's July 14th or something like that.
Okay. So I mean,
you can move.
I don't know that Jurassic World is. Let's see. Well, June 6th has Ballerina. That's a very. It might work. It might not.
Yeah. You could do that. You could do like beginning of June, and then you own most.
Or
of
just
June
go a week later. I mean, I feel like Mission Impossible up against Karate Kid and Life of Chuck is not, you know, I feel like you could definitely win that weekend, you know?
Yeah, you could. You definitely could. You know, it's one of those things where you kind of like, you could always go earlier and like literally, but it's like, it's one of those things where you're just like, I mean.
Oh yeah, if you drop a week earlier, you have what, Final Destination Bloodlines?
Yeah, exactly. Or yeah, you get Final Destination, which is nothing, and then you have your lead in to Lilo and Stitch. I mean, you know,
he's counting on that long weekend though.
Yep. I mean, we've seen it before where two movies have been like huge hits.
I mean, more Barbenheimer, it happened, but yeah. Man, that's a. You can't generate that. Like the studios have tried since then to generate that, and it's just, it doesn't happen. So I don't know. We'll see. Since I brought up Life of Chuck, for a movie that people like so many people have already seen in the industry, because it's been done for a year now,
almost a year. Yeah.
We finally got a trailer for Life of Chuck as well. Holy shit. What a fucking trailer.
It was leave it to Neon to do these effective trailers, right? Like, and it was super effective. Like, it kind of get, like, I don't know what to say other than, like, yeah, it's kind of super effective, and it kind of sells you. It sells you on, like, I don't even know how to put it. It's like, in the best way possible, it feels like what they couldn't do with Shawshank when it was initially released.
Yeah.
Like, none of those trailers worked for Shawshank, but this one, it feels like, oh, they actually kind of, it, like, it's a feeling more than it's a beat for beat movie. And, like, at least, like, that's what I feel like it should be if you're gonna make this story. And so, like, the whatchamacallit, the trailer should evoke that and say, it's kind of like, and I don't, I, like, it's, it's kind of like the way that Forrest Gump, they sold Forrest Gump, which is, it's like, it's not a movie about scenes, it's an experience, right? And Life of Chuck, like, at the end of the day, like, when you read that, like, I mean, is it a novella? Is it a book? I don't know, I can never kind of, like, put my finger on, like, what it truly is.
I mean, it's like part of a four novella. It's packaged with three other stories, much like Shawshank was.
Yeah.
I'm certain on the heels of this, it will be, you know, you'll see a release of The Life of Chuck as a small novel by itself, rather than the promoting of If It Bleeds, which I think is the what it's part of.
It's If It Bleeds, because it's with, it's with If It Bleeds.
It's like with the Holly Gibney story. So
but it's also like The Mist, where it's the longest, like, it almost feels like just couldn't pack anything more into it, because it would feel disingenuous to pack an extra 50 pages to make it a 300 page book, because it's like, I think it's like 250 or 249. Like, it's a long novella. Not to say that it's a bad thing. It's just, it's one of the books, like, it's one of those things where Stevie got out of hand with it, but that's the best possible thing about that book, is that it tells a very big story. But again, like, I feel like the trailer gives you the promise of an experience rather than just a bunch of scenes, right? Like, that's how trailers are kind of sold nowadays. Like, look at this scene, look at that scene. But this feels like it's like, you're going to be in for an experience, and it's not what you expect. I don't know, like, what was your feeling after you watched it?
Yeah, it's weird to say, it's because this is a story that if you haven't read the book, you absolutely should not go into this knowing anything about it, other than it's not a horror movie. Yes, it's Mike Flanagan. Yes, it's Stephen King. It's not a horror movie. I was going to say, it's weird to watch the trailer and recognize parts of the story and know what is happening in those moments.
Mm-hmm.
And also know that they're not giving anything away at all.
No, not at all. Not at all. Did you know that? I just learned this like a couple of days ago because somebody told me. Did you know that Nick Offerman is narrating it?
Yes.
I didn't know that. Which genuinely it surprised me, but it didn't. First off, because I wasn't sure if they were going to have a narration, which makes me feel like, does it make you feel good? Like, because it makes me feel good that there is a narration there. Like, I know, like,
if you're going to, it's weird. If you're going to do the story, I feel like the narration of it is a good move. It's kind of like in The Brothers Bloom. One of the things that bugs me about The Brothers Bloom is the way the narration falls away, because that's such a fun part of the very beginning of that movie by Ricky Jay.
Yeah.
And it just kind of disappears, which sucks. But, he's the perfect guy to do it. And I think it definitely needs something like that. Because, if you read the story, you know, part of it is, knowing, like, having somebody walk you through that, through what's going on, and you not necessarily having to figure it out.
And also, like, I feel like it's like, because you have somebody who's not in the cast and it's a discombobulated voice, that it works a little bit better. Like, it's like a on high kind of thing, kind of like, I know this is bad, it's been on my mind recently, but the way that Royal Tenenbaums is narrated, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
An omniscient third party that's not a part of the, like, you know, Alec Baldwin is the omniscient third party of it. And I feel like for the story and the way that it works and the way that it's constructed, and I feel like that's the perfect way to do it.
Or the Princess Bride.
Yeah.
Like, it's exactly that kind of thing that you need someone there to guide you along the story, because when things seem a little weird, or maybe they don't make sense, or the order is wrong, you need that person to just be like, but it's okay, it doesn't matter, like, we're just like, this isn't that story, this is a different story, we're just going to keep telling this story.
I'm
probably more excited for Life of Chuck than any other movie this year.
Yeah.
And that's saying a lot, because there's a lot of stuff I'm excited about this year.
This one is like high risk, high reward, because it's such a great King novel.
Everybody yeah. that's seen it has said the same fucking thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have seen it.
And it's weird, because like, some of the same people that have, like, that started off with the monkey saying how great the monkey was are the same people that said Life of Chuck is
kind
of brilliant.
And so they weren't wrong about the monkey. I've heard, like, I listened to the Filmcast guys talk about the monkey, and none of them were like huge fans. Like, they had a lot of problems with the movie, and I didn't get it, man. I was just like, this is one of the most well-made and constructed films I've seen in a very long time. And I feel like Life of Chuck is probably going to be in that vein, only with like the dramatics rather than like the goofy horror of it. Yeah,
exactly. It's neon, so I'm gonna be able to get, I already reached out to the people, and they're talking about, like, they're gonna start getting everybody, reviewers, to get in to see it early so they can start stumping for it, because neon thinks that it's their it's their big summer movie, and it's like a big summer, like, they're expecting it to be like a starter, like a true sleeper.
Yeah. That leaves you? Hello.
So I'm excited. I mean, they have confidence in it. I mean, like I said, that trailer really is a confident trailer, right? Like, it's a thing that makes you go,
yeah.
Yeah, this kind of way that you, like, I was telling, Christina hasn't read Life of Chuck, and I told her to wait until after, or she can make an audiobook version of it after, because I don't want her to ruin it. But she made a good point, which is, like, the way that they're promoting it is the way that, like, you know, old school Castle Rock movies used to be promoted. Like, this isn't, like, just go in, trust us. Like, you know, we're going to give you little bits and pieces, but to intrigue you, but go ahead and trust us. Or you can wait until all of your friends and family tell you, you really need to see this movie. Because, like, that's kind of like the way that it is. Like, it's got this confidence to it that I really, that you don't often see. Like, because trailers are always like, okay, so we're going to talk about another trailer where like, let's get into like F1, which is the exact opposite of that, which is like they literally are showing you and telling you the entire story and saying, you need to see this on the big screen. Like, we're going to give you the major beats. You kind of know what the movie's going to be about. I mean, it's Days of Thunder 2.0, but instead of Tony, you've literally got, you know, the team behind Top Gun Maverick coming back, except for it's F1 and Brad Pitt, right? Like, I watched it and I was like, man, there's like, I've seen the movie. If I really didn't want to, I don't have to go see this. Now, of course, I'm going to, because the promise of IMAX and a big screen and a big, stupid, like, summer popcorn movie, yeah, I'll go see it. Like, Joseph Kosinski has earned that right from me after Top Gun, and also, like, you know, Tron Legacy was, like, anything that he's done, it may be dumb, but the images and the way he pulls off things, like, what was that Tom Cruise, where Tom Cruise played twins? Oblivion.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that was a stupid fucking movie, but I will tell you, like, seeing that in IMAX was fucking impressive.
There was nothing in that movie that was like, oh, this is new and different and original. Like, a lot of it was like, oh, I see what you're doing. I saw where we were going. I knew what was coming. But it's a very well-made movie.
Yeah, a very well-made movie. It's big. It's ballsy. It's loud. And I feel like that's exactly what F1 is. Like, it literally was like, Brad Pitt saw Top Gun Maverick and said, I want this dude for my F1 movie. And they literally spent the last 3 years making this movie. I mean, it is impressive. Like, I will say, like, I kind of want to see it, and I want to see this trailer in IMAX, because, like, the visuals alone, like, and everything I've heard about, like, you know, they basically filmed Tom Cruise and Damon Idris, who plays the cocky kid that, like, you know, that he's going at. They learned how to be F1 racers. Like, they learned how to do it. And, like, how they did this movie was they filmed these scenes a week before. Like, they were trailing or moving ahead of the F1 racing teams during two seasons. Last season and the season before. That's how long they've been fucking filming this movie. And it looks impressive. Like, those scenes where...
I mean, it's everything he's been doing since Top Gun Maverick, right?
Yeah.
Like, he did... Yeah. Tron Legacy was his first movie, right?
Yep.
Which, that's a fucking, like... You don't see a lot of, like, out the gate, oh, here's a property we don't know what to do with. And some fucking weird ass ideas. Like, it doesn't really work. Like, there's a lot of not great stuff in that movie, but it takes some big fucking swings. And then he did Oblivion, which he co-wrote. I want to say, maybe I'm wrong, I want to say Oblivion started out as an idea for, like, a graphic novel. And it just morphed into a film.
Yeah, it was a graphic novel.
Okay.
And then
what? Only the Brave after that?
Like, which is, like, of fire movies, like, you know, of, like, the fireman movies. Like, I will tell you, it's a harrowing, like, movie. I don't know if you've seen it. But it's based on one of those, like one of those, like, Men Health's magazine or, like, GQ articles about a wildfire that got out of hand and a whole bunch of smoke jumpers died. It's effective. It is super, super effective. Like, I was genuinely impressed by it. Like, I didn't see it until way later. And I was like, you know what? I kind of would have liked to have seen this on the big screen.
It had a pretty good cast. It just wasn't anything that looked intriguing to me. Because, I mean, it's what, Brolin and Bridges and Miles Teller and Jennifer Connelly and Taylor Kitsch. And, he's really good at amassing a cast. And then, you know, after Oblivion failed, like I hate to give Tom Cruise a lot of credit for anything, but like he does seem to be able to not hold people's failures against them. Because Oblivion didn't do well. To have him come back and do Maverick, and then what he did Spiderhead the same year, right? But Spiderhead was, I don't know. I feel like there was something. I didn't watch it, but it was. I know it was a Netflix film, but
yeah, it's okay. Like that's the thing. Is like it's okay. It's a Netflix movie. Like that's the thing. Is that like okay? So the one thing that I've taken away from Kaczynski's career is he very much so like. Like, if you watch all of these movies and the things that he's starting to amass, is that he's very much like Tony is, like Tony used to be, is that he's a maximalist at style, right? And visuals. And if he doesn't have a great script locked down and he doesn't have a great writer to give him things, it's empty visuals. And that's what Spiderhead is Winnick and Reese, like, unless they're writing Deadpool movies with Ryan Reynolds,
yeah,
I don't.
That's far not, back well, I know we've already talked about this on previous episodes, but much like I saw a like an overview of the Captain America guys.
Ophelia McPhelis or
no, the directors, the Russo brothers.
Oh, Joe and the Russo
brothers. And it was like breaking down all the Russo brothers movies, like from their first movie, which I think is actually underrated. Like, I think Welcome to Collinwood is an underrated film.
Dude, that fucking movie, just for the fact, like, just the George Clooney cameo alone is fucking awesome. Like, I agree with you. Welcome to Collinwood, is kind of great
because but you look at their film career.
Oh my god.
And it's just like,
I mean, we've that, got enough.
And it's just like, oh, okay, well, like, it, just looking at critically what people think, it's like, okay, the only critical successes they've had are their box office successes in the Marvel movies. Like, and I feel like Kaczynski... not Kaczynski, Warner and Reese have the same kind of track record.
Yes. No, 100%. 100%. I mean, these are like Russo, the Russo brothers are the guys who made You, Me, and Dupree. Like, they should have never been taken out of fucking jail for that movie. Like, that movie, like, I'm a guy that likes, like, that will find good in a lot in shitty movies. That movie through and through, like, that movie almost ended Kate Hudson's career. Like you gotta like think about that. Like it literally de facto ended Owen Wilson's career. And if it wasn't for the oh wow memes, that motherfucker would not be where he is right now. Like that movie ended people's careers. And like it's wild to me that like it took them 8 years to get something, but then they get come back with like they're TV directors, man. But like Winnick and Reese are not even that, but
well, like, I don't know. I would put them as television story creators because outside of Deadpool and maybe the first Zombieland movie, the only thing they've created that we can point to and be like, that's great is Twisted Metal. Well, Joe Schmo Show, I think, was them.
Yeah, they did too. The Joe Schmo Show. Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, Winnick and Reese, yeah. I mean, have Winnick and Reese done a movie with the Russos? Did they do
No, let's get that team up together. Cause
oh, my God, could you imagine?
That would be great.
Oh, man. You know,
but it's like, got to be a Marvel movie because the only things they can do are Marvel movies.
Or do we think that? Okay, so like, let me ask a serious question. Like, I personally feel Winnick and Reese are there to rein in Ryan Reynolds. I honestly think that, like,
yeah,
they're there to rein him in and to give him structure, because, like you said, Zombieland is like the first Zombieland is good, but I also feel like that one is like, I don't know, like it's kind of weird because, like, if you watch it now, it's not cringe, but it's pretty close.
Yeah, there's some stuff in there that's just like, eh. But I think maybe that's why the second one doesn't really work.
Oh yeah.
So,
like,
you know,
to be honest, like Zombieland, I think the reason why everybody liked Zombieland was because of Bill Murray. Like, let's be honest. Like, that's that and Woody being Woody, are like the two things people really liked about that movie. Yeah, I don't know, man. Like they're wild. Like, they, like, Life is Terrible. It's a terrible alien ripoff.
Speaking of people who should maybe stick to TV and Zombieland, Ruben Fleischer.
Oh my god, fucking Ruben Fleischer, man. Like, he had everything, and then he did Gangster Squad, and and then they gave him another thing. They let him do Uncharted, and then they also let him do Venom. What the fuck, man? Like,
I liked the first Venom movie. I generally like all of them, but they are very just not good. But, like, he's been working with Justin Spitzer on his last two shows. He's directed episodes of St. Denis, and he directed episodes of Superstore. Like, he's a producer on that. He's also he's directed
favorite TV show Jury Duty, which is coming back.
Yeah. So, and he was part of the Santa Clarita Diet crew too. So,
yeah, you know. Maybe he's more of a idea guy. Because I fucking hate Uncharted because I wanted to love that movie so much, but when you get Say Hi to Your Mother for Me, and Tom Holland, and you get them together, and it's just like, it becomes this, like, Tom Holland is, like, I'm going to make a really wild statement, but Tom Holland is only as good as his co-stars that are around him. He's very Michael J. Fox. Like, he's very Foxy. Like, Foxy was always great because he had great people around him, right? Like, think about it. Like, I'm not going to beseech him, but his best movies, he always has great casts around him. Like, Christopher Lloyd, the more I watch Back to the Future, the more I recognize and realize that Christopher Lloyd is the fucking glue and soul of those movies. The reason why those movies, like, the first one works is because fucking he dies. And you spend this whole entire time falling in love with Christopher Lloyd and going, fuck, Marty really needs to fucking save this dude. Holland is the same way, man. He's like, you know, the better cast he has around him. And when you, like I said, when you have Say Hi to Your Mother for Me, like, I refuse to talk about him because he's just, he's in a new Shane Black movie.
Yeah.
That's produced by Robert Downey Jr. Like it hasn't been released because there's trouble with it. And Shane Black is fighting the studios. And so is Robert Downey Jr. But he's the lead in it. And I'm like, really? Really? Like, why can't you just do Mel Gibson movies, bro? I know, Rip.
But all that to say, like, the Formula One movie looks like it could be great. I mean, you're talking about a dude whose first movie Disney spent a shit ton of money on and grossed $400 million, which seems like a lot, but, like, I want to say that Tron movie, they spent like $300 million on with marketing and everything.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. At least $300 million. I heard rumors that Oblivion cost more than, like, double the money that they said that it cost. They said that it cost $120 million, but I heard that, like, with all the bullshit what I understood about Kaczynski and Cruz and what they love about each other is that they're perfectionists. And, like, part of Oblivion and the reason why it got so out of hand was because they're both super perfectionists. And Cruise loved that about Kaczynski. It's the reason why he brought him on to Top Gun.
And I mean, it's why for 2.5 years it been working on this F1 movie.
Like, and Pitt also as well loves perfectionists. He loves guys that will get the thing to make it elevated. So as much as I fucking say, like, the trailer looks like it looks like I've seen this movie 4 times before, which I probably have, I'm going to be there opening day. And I guarantee you that it's going to be big. Like, it's going to look big. It's going to sound big. You're going to want to see it the way that you saw Top Gun Maverick, which is the best possible theater that's closest in your area.
Yeah.
Which,
you know? I appreciated the kind of minimalist early trailer that was just him driving.
The one that has We Will Rock You, but it only has clapping.
Yeah.
And the guitar. Yeah.
Yeah.
I liked that one too. I saw it in the theater in real IMAX because I went to go see something in real IMAX, and I can tell you you've been to one. I know that you have one close you don't have one super close, but I know that you have
yeah,
one.
Yeah, it's within 30 minutes of me though.
Yeah. So. The real IMAX one. Man, that hurt my ears when the guitar riff started.
Yeah.
It was just like a goddamn, like you were at a concert and Queen decided, like, let's put it up to 11. So yeah, no, I'm here for it. I'm here for it. Any other thoughts about this, or were there any other trailers that we were?
No. No, let's get into me relitigating
that's a good
Daredevil.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you listen last week, Adam way more I don't want to say appreciative, but I guess that's the right word, really enjoyed the first 2 episodes of Daredevil more than I did. I was like, I don't think this is a very good show, guys. I rewatched them with my lady friend Stephanie. She enjoyed them. I enjoyed them a lot more. I was able to see kind of like past the what I wanted it to be into like, oh, here's what they're doing. And then now in hindsight of watching episode 3, which Adam, I assume you watched.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
We can talk about it.
So spoilers for episode 3. I can now look at it and be like, okay, well, I see what you're doing now. Episode 3 is not a Daredevil show at all. Oh. I mean, it's fucking wild to me. First of all, he didn't kill those cops, I guess.
No, he did. But and he didn't even look like he really fucked them up, even though he really fucked them up in the last in that second episode. There's a lot of thoughts about this. Like, so you're right, it is not a Daredevil episode. It's literally it's a
courtroom drama.
Yeah, it's a courtroom drama. To which that has, like, I mean, we know the writing's on the wall, right? Like, it's a tragedy. Like, it's literally a, like, an injustice, just, like, it's an injustice. It's very much so of the, To Kill a Mockingbird. It's, like, literally To Kill a White Tiger. Kind of, like, injustice of injustices, like, courtroom drama. And it kind of sets, like, the first two, the first two episodes were kind of like, they were truly a soft reboot. And this kind of like sets the table for what everything in this episode feels like what we're going to be dealing with for the rest of the time in Daredevil. What is your thought about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the thing that will help pull him back into this world. is the death of this hero vigilante, which sadly we didn't really talk about this last week. You know, that they dedicated the first episodes to Kamar de los Reyes, because he passed away. He was pretty sick while they were filming.
And yeah, they knew. He knew, and they, I think that they said that they knew when they were filming it.
Yeah.
That's what, like, you know, he had been very upfront with them in regards to it. He had cancer, unfortunately.
Yeah. This is a, he's a, you know, I hate to call him a bit player, because it's the, what's, there's no small parts, only small actors. I mean, but this is a guy that's been acting for 40 years or something like that. In all kinds of things, you know, going back to like ER in the 90s, you know, and you know, this is his opus. I mean, this is his swan song, literally. And I mean, it's fucking great. It's a really good episode of television. I don't know if the show can get better on a like dramatic human front than this. Superhero wise, I'm sure they can do a lot of things and, you know, have it be action heavy, because there's not a ton of action in this episode really at all.
Not an action beat. It's an assassination. Like, you know, so it's like, I mean, but it doesn't need that, right? Like it's all drama. Like it's all like, the show is kind of like, it's very confident in what it, like this episode feels so confident. It feels like, so like we talked last week about, so I did some research, and okay, so we have to so Corman and Ord were the original guys. It's actually Dario Scarpanti that is actually the showrunner that took over when Moorhead and Benson became executive producers and directors. So like the guy who actually did it is the guy who actually ran, who was the lead writer on The Punisher, the Netflix show Punisher, the one that we love. So like, I feel like this feels like, after the soft reboot, this feels more like his world and the dangers and the darkness of his world, but also the light of like what he's doing, which is like, it really does, like everything feels elevated in this episode. It's like a confident kind of like, we don't need the superhero stuff. We're just going to tell you a story and we're going to let it play out. And we're going to have moments that are going to be like a thriller, and not like a superhero thriller, but an actual thriller. Like that whole moment with the switch, what do they call that? The switch with the confidential informant. Cherry. Like that's like truly like they understand that Matt's not going to die. Right. But we absolutely think that the CI is going to die. And like the actual amount of like thrills and like tension that they're able to wring out of all of these things and make it like something that you actually care about is truly impressive to me. You know, all the twists and turns, like it doesn't sit on like your, it doesn't sit there and go, it's a court thing, so we're going to just do the Law and Order thing. Like that would be so crass of somebody to say it's Law and Order or Daredevil. It's not, it's better than even a special episode of Law and Order, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because of what they do and because of what they say. And like that monologue, man, fucking that killed me, because you know, like, because if you know his story and you know what he's like, it's just, it added layers upon layers. Hey, man.
Yeah. I was blown away by this episode. And you're right. Like, I guess I just wasn't looking at Dario, however, I'm not going to mispronounce his last name. Yeah, I mean, this it's the guy, he did both seasons of The Punisher and followed up The Punisher with a show I didn't watch, but I heard a lot about. He was a producer on Jack Ryan for Amazon. Yeah.
It takes it slow, but I will tell you that by the second season and then the third season, it's like there's no wonder to me why they're making a movie now, because they found their footing in their Jack Ryan universe. The first season is it's trudge, but that second and third has like definitely a confidence to it. And he also
he came into the later seasons. Like, he wasn't there in the first season. Like, he comes in towards the end, so that's probably why.
And also, like, he's supposedly he's writing the Punisher television special too.
Oh, okay. That's great. Like,
yeah,
I still would like a lighthearted Daredevil at some point.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it is what it is. Like, they wanted to go with something. It's like, oh, well, let's give the people what we know that they like. And this is, like, right in line with that. So, like, while I reevaluated the first episodes and was like, I was probably a little bit too harsh. After the third episode, like, I have a lot of confidence in what this show is doing. Still don't think they had to kill Foggy to get here, but
so, okay. let's talk about that. So, like, have you been hearing these whole things? So I didn't know that there was a storyline of like a secret life of Foggy. Do you know about that? And can you talk to me about that?
I mean, a little bit. It's comics, right? Like, you know, you need something to happen, so you kill a character, or or you put them in harm's way, or you alter the status quo because a new writer came in and I forget who it was, but yeah, I mean, at one point in time, Foggy's not there. He's dead. And what you find out eventually, because another new writer comes in and is like, but I don't want Foggy to be dead, is that Foggy has been living this whole secret life and he wasn't dead. And, you know, it's fine. It's fun storytelling. Comics have to constantly reinvent themselves because, I mean, comics, you get Act One pretty early on, and every comic book story, especially, you know, for these ongoing things, it's all Act Two. Like,
yeah,
you can't end the show. You have to find a way to just reinvent it. It's soap operas, you know. Characters that you think are dead, they're not dead, even if you saw the body. Like, famously, there's only a handful of characters who have not returned in comics. For a long time, Bucky was one of those. until Ed Brubaker was like, you know what would be really, really great? Is let's resurrect Bucky, and he's the Winter Soldier. And, like, but now we have that. So,
but also, like, Bucky was like a little Robin-esque little shit, like, before... Like, and
the Bucky that you get in the Captain America movies. He was very much a little kid, like a 14-year-old kid that had somehow found his way over overseas, and Captain America kind of was just like took him under his wing and, you know, kept him from getting hurt, only to famously have him wind up dead and Captain America frozen in ice. So yeah, it's is there a chance that Foggy's not dead? Yeah, but I also feel like, while I don't like that you killed Foggy, undercutting that emotional beat that you started the series with is kind of fucked up and is not gonna win you any points with the audience you do have. They're just be like, oh, wait, he wasn't really dead? what? It undercuts a lot of stuff you've done with the show in three episodes. Like, it undercuts all these emotional beats with Matt and Karen. Why are they so like this? You know, their conversation outside the courtroom it's rough. Like, it's like, I still don't understand why this tragedy had to undo everything. And she's just like, yeah, but it did, you know?
Yeah. So, true grief does. Like, I mean, yeah, that's the thing is, like,
it does.
It really does.
100% does.
It really, like, what I'm liking about the show, which I don't feel really, I don't know if it really, like, you know, because I told you, I'm rewatching the other stuff, the Netflix stuff. But what I don't feel like I felt that I feel here is that this show doesn't play nice. Like, yeah, there's a sense of it with the first, like, with the seasons, but it feels very Netflixy, which means, like, the melodrama of it all. Like, this doesn't feel like it's playing nice in the way that I feel like a great show doesn't play nice. Like, do you know what I mean? Like yeah, the way that they just systematically kill White Tiger, like, and, you know, everybody is thinking the same, like, everybody's thinking the same thing. Oh, shit, it's Punisher, which, I mean, we both know that it's not the Punisher. We both know that it's not
Frank. Yeah,
I mean, that's all a bait and switch, but at the same time,
I'm excited for what happens when they introduce the Punisher and he is not okay with these cops kind of taking his logo and... Like, that's also a storyline from the comics, is him very much saying, like, you're not me. You're not supposed to be me. Like, you're supposed to... I'm not on your side. Like, you're not supposed to be on my side. You're supposed to represent the good. Like, and I'm, you know, what I do is not good.
No, it's not. And like my thing is like, how angry is Frank going to be?
Yeah.
Like how angry? Because he was so basically what I like is it's going to be the recall of the Punisher story without having to do a whole deep dive into a re-origin story, because you're literally setting up Frank's family was murdered because of, not just because of the mob, but because of crooked cops.
Yeah.
And they are basically, essentially, they don't know that he's, like, they don't know Frank is who he is, right? They just know the Punisher and what they think of the Punisher. And this is so kind of, like, it's so juicy. I don't even want to get into it, but it's so juicy that it's something that we talked about a long time ago. You remember how we talked about how it was like, I don't want them to fucking do Punisher anymore. Fuck that. Like, you remember, like, I said that a long time when they were first starting this. And the reason why I was like, because I don't fucking like those assholes that make fucking Punisher into some sort of fucking hero, and they do it for the wrong reasons. They're literally doing this story that I was like, the only way that I want them is if they did it this way. And they're literally doing what I didn't think that they would ever do. Because it's like, they're touching some really touchy ground here, but I also think it's like riveting touchy ground, right? Because fuck it, might as well show people who for the fucking fools that they are. Like, you know, like I almost wonder if it's going to be this whole thing of like, is it any way possible that it's like Frank gets put in and Frank becomes who he is, and it forces Matt to become Daredevil to stop him? Like, he
very well could be. And, you know, we were talking about people that are going to have good years this year. I mean, you know, John Bernthal is probably on that list of people who might have very good fucking years, because he's got a long run of the Punisher about to hit. The Bear, is it this year or next year? Final season.
No, it's this year.
So this later year, this year, we'll have the final season of The Bear. The Accountant 2 is out soon, right?
It's out in the end of next month.
Yeah, and like I read an early review that was like, "Hey, this is a fun movie." So
yeah.
And then he's got, of course, he's going to be in. I think he's going to be in The Odyssey too, but that's next year.
That's next year.
And he's got a new TV series or something. His and Hers, him and Tessa Thompson playing like detectives or something.
Yeah. Which I like.
Sounds
yeah,
fun.
It, yeah. Like, it's like, oh, okay. I mean, like Brenthal's range is very limited. Right. But within that limited range, I love him. Like, give me
him. Oh, and the amateur too. He's in the amateur. Oh, that's right.
He is in the amateur. Yeah. To which, if you guys don't know what the amateur is, yeah, you need to know what that is.
I can't wait to see Rami Malek.
Rami Malek go yeah, for Jason.
I'm so on board for this. Like, and that cast looks so great. Bernthal and Rachel Brosnahan and Lawrence Fishburne and
what's his name? The guy, the other guy, the boss who always plays like he's like the boss. I'll get it right now. Like it all looks like real. Oh, Holt McNally.
Yeah.
I love Holt McNally. Just the cast alone is worth it. It is like, you know, okay, I'm there. I'm just there. But the concept of like making Rami Malek a unexpected like avenging hero is, I mean, he's fucking Rami Malek.
Bernthal, man, I'm excited for his return as the Punisher, which I thought would be this week, but now I guess maybe seems like it'll be next week.
Did you know something weird? Like, I did not know this until recently. I heard him on a podcast and he mentioned it. Did you know that Kurt Angle is his uncle-in-law because he married one of?
Yeah.
I did not know that. Did not know that his wife was like is a niece of Kurt Angle. Like, that was so weird to me. I was like, what? Okay. That's interesting.
Aaron, I think is his wife's name.
Yeah.
Aaron Angle.
And you know that he went to Harvard too, right? Yeah. Like, that's another thing that I didn't know about him. I was like, this motherfucker going to Harvard and Kurt Angle? I was like, okay. It's just because
he studied in Moscow too.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. That's Moscow Theater, whatever it's called, Moscow Company? Art Theater. Okay. Yeah.
The Moscow, I think it's like Moscow Theater Arts or something like that. Moscow Theater. Damn, that's crazy. I guess.
Yeah, his like bona fides are like, it's pretty legit. Like, he's a real fucking actor who like just got his break playing a hard ass. And so now that's kind of what we see, or kind of like what we pigeonhole him into.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very comfortable in that role too. So,
oh no, absolutely. But he's also like he's like, what I like about Brenthal and what I liked about his Punisher was that it's the Lee Marvin thing where, like, when you watch Lee Marvin, after you've watched a few Lee Marvin movies, it's hard to swatch a pretty boy act tough and it be real. The suspension of disbelief is so hard. But then when you watch Brenthal, there's this suspension of disbelief because he is that person. Like it may be a front, but he, like, you know, there's something about, there's a harder edge to him that's not there on a lot of other people, right? It's an authenticity.
He's better than what we, like I said, have kind of pigeonholed him into. He's actually really, really funny. Like the I may have mentioned this show before, but the first thing I ever saw John Bernthal in was David Crane show. It was only on for 1 year. It was called The Class. It's about a guy who in his like late 20s winds up reunited with like his closest friends from, I can't remember if it's like middle school or elementary school or even like early high school, but like it's John Bernthal, Lizzie Kaplan, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, Sean McGuire, Lucy Punch, Jason Ritter, David Keith is in it. Jamie King was in it. Sarah Gilbert was in it. Like it was an insanely stacked show that nobody fucking watched. And it was absolutely hysterical. And Bernthal was like him, Sean McGuire, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, and Lizzie Kaplan. Oh, and Andrea Anders. They were the big, like, core group. And I mean, I guess maybe it's lucky the show didn't go, because then we don't have Jesse Tyler Ferguson in Modern Family. But yeah, it was like 2006. But yeah, I remember like watching Bernthal being like, this dude's legit, man. And then all of a sudden, he's just this badass dude who shows up in The Walking Dead. And like, he's kind of just always playing that role now, more or less. But then
he's weird. Like, he does these like brother roles. Like, I call them the brother roles because have you ever seen, like, it's a beautiful movie. It's a very, like, I love it. Not many people have seen it. The Peanut Butter Falcon. Have you ever seen that?
No, everybody tells me I should watch it.
Niagara Falls, Frankie, Niagara Falls. But he plays Shia LaBeouf's brother in it, like one of his brothers. And it's just like, he's so good. Like, he's like good in the way that he's good in The Bear. Like, he comes in and he pops in and he's like, he's just this like bright shining light. He's also good in Ford versus Ferrari, where he's not playing like a psychopath. Like, it's kind of interesting how like he plays these oftentimes he plays these psychopaths or these bullies or these violent men, but he's also really, really fucking good in these like smaller roles where he plays like these guys that are just good. I watched the first episode of American Gigolo. He's good. I didn't watch the rest of it. Just too much out there, right? But he's gonna have a big year this year, which is good for him. Like, there could be worse things that happen than having John Bernthal in more movies and more content.
I hope this if it's a miniseries or whatever that he has with Tessa Thompson gives us a different Bernthal than we've had the last, 10, 15 years or so. Because while again, like he's great as Shane, he's great as the Punisher, he's great. Yeah, and it's good that he gets to do those smaller things and kind of stretch those acting chops. I want to see him, and I want something like that to be bigger for him, so that maybe people don't only see him as the Walking Dead dude and the Punisher. So
yeah, absolutely. Like, I really do hope that, like, and also like it's just, give the guy a chance beyond like what you normally see him at, like what you're normally seeing him in. I really do hope it works. I feel like this one is going to be like, it's so weird, but I feel like this one's going to be one that we're going to come back to possibly week to week, especially if it's as good as it continues to like serve us as good as it does. I think that Daredevil Reborn is going to be something that we're going to come back to at least to talk for like 10 minutes about.
Yeah.
Especially if it delivers. any other final thoughts about that one?
No, I'm excited to see where it goes, and like now more than ever. So,
yeah.
And so I think the only other thing we definitely both watched this week, you more so than me, is The Righteous Gemstones is back.
Yes, it is. And they came back hard.
What a swing, man. What a swing. Like, I was ready to jump back into the wild, wacky, like, zany shit, especially after seeing the trailer.
Yes.
I was like, oh, this is going to be fun. We have, like, just, it looks crazy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and everybody doing crazy shit again. Like literally the gemstones and the various other people that are around the gemstones. Like, you know, Baby Billy,
you have John Goodman with that long hair, which is like, okay. What are we getting into this season?
Yeah, like, what's going to happen what's going to happen with Keith and Kelvin? I mean, like, you think all of this stuff, right? What's going to happen between Judy and, BJ? What's going to happen with them? Like, there's all this, like, in the air, but then they fucking, man, they go back and the episode is called Prelude, and they show us the beginning of the gemstones' legacy as creatures. And I'm going to say something up front, to which I know I have talked a lot of shit about certain things and certain views and certain eras that we really shouldn't be making films in and TV in. I'm going to stop it right here and say this. Danny McBride writing and directing this episode and showing us something, this feels like it's absolutely necessary where this particular piece of history for the gemstones takes place. It's not being crass. It's not being like,
oh, every time it gets to the line of like, we're making fun of this, it somehow recovers.
Exactly. 100%. And like, I know how they did it. Like, all you need to do is listen to Danny McBride on the Ringer podcast with Fennessy and luckily what's his name is not there to make inappropriate comments, Bill Simmons, but Fennessy and Chris, I can't think of his name. Chris, Jesus Christ, I can't remember, but they did an episode with Danny after the show dropped, and talking about how they got Bradley motherfucking Cooper to star, to take the role of the first gemstone, the first gemstone who takes his place, like, and it's so, fuck man, I got so many thoughts about this, but takes his place as a preacher. Like, in the Confederate South during the Civil War, Elijah Gemstone, and how he, like, I don't know, man, like, this, it's a wild, wild, like, it's wild, but it's so fitting and good, and it critiques so much. It's fucking great,
man. Like, I was riveted. Like, just, and not, like, there's some funny stuff in it. And I think maybe as a movie-going public or society or whatever, I think we've forgotten that Bradley Cooper is a funny dude. Like, yeah. I know there's the Rocket Raccoon of it all, but, like, you kind of just forget that he's Rocket most of the time.
Yes, but because he's so good, like, okay, is it weird to say that Bradley Cooper may be one of the more underrated actors? that's currently working.
It's weird because he's not necessarily underrated.
I mean, he's because, won an Oscar.
Yeah, he's got a lot of acclaim, but it is weird that, like, I feel like maybe we sleep on Bradley Cooper, which is a weird thing to say because he's like in the Jay-Z so stuff much is. Shit. Like, you know, but like,
or like,
it's his willingness to do things, I think, that I'm constantly amazed by, like showing up in Abbott Elementary or being in Dungeons and Dragons for fucking 5 minutes. You know, that movie was only 2 years ago, but nobody saw it. And that's another one you can point to is like, we're forgetting how good Bradley Cooper actually is because so much is focused on his dramatic work that you're forgetting this man is funny and also can be extremely unlikable.
Yes. Well, I mean, all you need to do is look at Wedding Singer or Wedding Crashers.
Yeah.
He is such an asshole in that movie. Like, the perfect
so much
asshole.
So that, like, for years, it was just like, fuck that guy. I don't like that guy.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, it, like it's so fucking wild to, like it's like what, like, you know, it's the you forgot about Dre. Like, that's the whole thing, is that you forget about how good he is and how much, like, I mean, like, all you need to do is look at Licorice Pizza. Like, he's in the last, 10 minutes of Licorice Pizza playing John Peters. And he is so funny, so unlikable, but so kind of on point, like, and, like, watchable. Like, there's a part of me that really, like, he's the kind of actor that 15 years ago, if he had done this kind of work, would be in Scorsese's next movie. Like, it actually disappoints me that he isn't in Scorsese's next movie, right? Because, like, he has this ability to be, like Brenthal, be funny, unlikable, but you still are magnetically drawn to him. Like, you watch him in this episode of The Righteous Gemstones. He kills people. And not in the most pleasant of ways, right?
Yeah.
He literally shoots a dude in the head, and then to make sure that he gets away with it, literally beats a dude's face in. And then he chokes out a dude that helps him win at a poker game because he knows that the guy's going to rat him out eventually. Like, and literally sits there, and we watch him choke him out. And the whole entire time we are watching this, and yeah, like, he's a piece of shit, but we go with him on this journey. Like, we literally watch him on this journey. And, like, never at a moment, like, there are some moments that are super dark. And then they let him have, like the moment with the firing squad. Like, I literally sat there and I'm like, oh, fuck. And then he says what he says.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but fucking laugh. But then the next minute, he says this thing to these guys. And you're like, oh shit. Like he's fucking there. Like he knows. Like he may be a murderer, he may be an asshole, he may be a scoundrel. Like, he's a true definition of a scoundrel. Like he's a rapscallion. Like, he fucking doesn't care about anybody. But then, like, there's those moments where you just go, fuck, it takes your breath away at just how he's able to turn that corner very quickly. Like, I was stunned. I was stunned so much that I've watched it 3 times just because it's him. Like, what he does and how Danny McBride, like, it's weird because it's also the way that Danny McBride shoots him. He doesn't shoot him like a movie star, like, not in the traditional sense, like, but he gives him enough space and enough distance to let him, like, inhabit the role. Like, he doesn't, like, do the movie star thing where he's, like, constantly in his face, but those moments where Cooper has to sell the moment and has to be that movie star, he does it. Like, man, like, this is, like, it's, I don't often say this, but they're, like, it feels like this is like the first piece of gem. Like, this is the first time in Gemstones and the first time in a while for me where I'm like, this is where movies don't eclipse TV. That TV is like, can be this thing that builds up everything and gives you a moment where it is cinema, but it's because of everything that's come before it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's not an anomaly because all of the people involved are capable of doing like this level of work. Yeah. But it's also one of those things where it's like, oh, you not only do you forget Bradley Cooper can do stuff like this and turn on that dime from like dramatic to funny to like horrible, but like you see Danny McBride and it's easy to dismiss him as this loud, obnoxious, overbearing goofball, crude dipshit because of like what he's good at doing. But it's like, okay, but yeah, also he's a very competent director. He's a very he's an extremely good writer. And it's easy to forget that when all you're seeing is Jesse Gemstone or, you know, any of the other, God, what was the pitcher's name?
Oh shit. I just forgot it. Oh, good Lord. Eastbound and Down.
This is Ricky something, right? Or am I thinking Ricky Bobby?
I think you're thinking Ricky Bobby. Jesus, I'll get it in a second. Kenny Powers.
Kenny Powers, that's right.
Yeah. Kenny Powers, or who was the guy he played in Vice Principals? Good Lord. Gamby. Neil Gamby. Yeah. Yeah, it's easy to see these like loudmouth, like shitty human beings, but like, you know what the thing is? Like, here's the thing is like, I think he just proved with this okay, I'm going to throw something at you. Like, you know how they say, like, in the industry and in the making of things, that everybody says drama is easy, comedy is hard? Did he just prove that with this episode?
I mean, kind of, sort of.
Danny McBride went, I can write drama. Watch, I'm going to show you. And he writes this fucking prelude that's like everything that prestige TV is supposed to be, but it's in the middle of it's the beginning of the end for a comedic TV show, right? But also not just a comedic TV show, but I feel like The Righteous Gemstones to me, and I was going to ask you this, I feel like it's the most challenging comedy that's on TV right now. Like, it's easy for me to like because I like this kind of stuff. But if you were to show this to, like, not all of America would love this. Like, it's made for a certain, who's it made for? Because it's not made for one side, because the one side laughs at it. Like, the one side, they would feel like they're being made fun of. But then the other side is like, well, you're being too hero worshipy with it.
Yeah.
So it's like,
yeah.
But at the same time, it manages to be fun.
It's towing a weird line. Feel
like whoever watches it, like everybody, right? Or am I wrong?
No, you're right. It's towing a very weird line. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Something's going on with my mic. Okay. Anyway, yeah, I think you're exactly right. It's this weird line that they're towing that nobody asked them to tow, nobody wants them to tow, but they're just like, hey, you know what? Like, these people weren't good people, but they also weren't bad people.
Yeah.
In their own eyes. There's a weird difference between doing something out of ignorance and doing something out of malice. And like it's that kind of line. I was like, it's a lot of, oh, this happened and these people participated out of ignorance, not necessarily out of malice. And they do a really, really good job of walking that line. And you're right, like people on either side of the line would point at it and go, this isn't okay. Like you're either mocking us or, hey, you're not harsh enough with those people. And it's like, yeah, well, they're still people. And
yeah,
a lot of them are just ignorant. And like, that doesn't mean it has to be hateful. It also doesn't mean it can't be funny. So
yeah, and it doesn't also have to be like, you know, in like, there's this, it's the difference between empathy and sympathy that I think that we've lost a lot of in our, like, not even just our, like I'm not going to talk about our current era, but I'm just going to talk about it like in filmmaking. Like, we've gotten to this point now where like showing behavior becomes like this whole thing of like, we're condoning it, which I don't think that, like, I think that nobody in the show would say that they're condoning theft and conning of people, right? Like, they're not doing that. But what they are doing is that they're showing, like it's like 70s filmmaking, right? Like, we will always talk about 70s filmmaking and what makes 70s filmmakers great. And, like, they're doing it on a weekly basis when this show comes out, which is that they are showing an empathetic portrait. Like, they're not condoning it. They're not saying, oh, yeah, these people are, like these people deserve to have, like, you know, deserve to be put on a pedestal. But what they are doing is, like, they're showing, like, everybody's human. Everybody makes mistakes, but also everybody, like, does intentionally shitty things. And it's kind of, like, what I love about the Gemstones is that it's, like, yeah, nobody's perfect. But then again, you know what? Nobody in this world is. And they just managed to toe that line perfectly of, like, it's human. Like, that's the thing, is that this show is human, right? And sometimes it goes to the really, what the kids love to call, cringe.
Yeah.
But also, true. Yeah. But also, it leads to these wild moments. Like, I'm thinking about the BJ fight. Like,
yeah.
That to me, fuck, man. Like, if there's ever been a moment where I literally, like, so I do this thing, and it only happens every once in a while, but it always happens on Gemstones. And my wife has not watched the whole thing. She wants to wait until it fit. Like, we're going to start it as soon as this season finishes, and she's going to watch it all. But she sees me all the time, and she always looks at me strange. I stand up in my seat, and I kind of walk away from the TV while I'm watching it from the side, because I feel like this amount of embarrassment. And I will tell you, at least once an episode, it didn't happen this episode, but once an episode, there is a moment where I literally have to walk away from the TV at a, what I call a safe distance, because it's so cringe inducing to me. And like, it's those moments, like the BJ fight, he gets the shit kicked out of him, and then he turns around and he does the most, it's a weird ass like moment, because it's so wildly, like, it recalls something like what he talked about like three episodes before, and it pays it off so beautifully. But like, those moments are so a part of just Danny McBride and Jody Hill and these guys, this crew of, and David Gordon Green, the three guys, the North Carolina crew, who have created this show and created shows like, you know, the three shows, Vice Principals, Eastbound and Down, and The Righteous Gemstones. But it's like, here more than anything else, it's like their masterwork. Like, I don't even know, dude, like after this, where do you go? Like, honestly, like, I don't know, like, are they going to take a break? Like, I mean, it took them 2 years to make this season.
Yeah.
A lot of it.
I imagine they've got something in the pipeline, like, you know, because they also worked on what, Halloween and The Exorcist, which I know that those are like your kind of like cribbing stuff there, because a lot of the legwork has already been done for you.
Yeah.
But Yeah, I don't know. They seem to keep working.
Yeah,
so they do. I don't know that'll stop, you know?
No.
It'll probably be a movie, I guess.
I almost wonder if it is going to be a movie. Like, because, or maybe, like, because, like, when they're not in the comedy stuff, like, I mean, like you said, they all are a part of the, all three of them were a part of the Halloween and The Exorcist. And those are not, like, they're not, like, they're so opposite of what they, like, of this comedy stuff. But then also David Gordon Green, I mean, he is like we talk about, like, you know, like Bradley Cooper, like, you know, people not remembering things. Like, David Gordon Green was like an art film director until he did, I mean, you know, like literally did shit like, you know, man, I mean, it's like Prince Avalanche and Joe, you know, like he did the like Undertow, All the Real Girls, Snow Angels. Like he did all these like weird artistic movies. Yeah. And like,
dude, his early stuff, yeah, I fucking like George Washington, Shotgun Stories, yeah. Prince Avalanche, like Joe, like they're so fucking good. But like you would look at that and be like, that's not the same guy.
No, exactly. You'd be like, huh, what are you talking about? Like that is not the same dude. You know, I mean, and the weirder part is Danny McBride is in all of those fucking movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like my favorite is that he's in All the Real Girls and he plays a character named Bustass, which I never got over. Like I found that was funny. And then our dude Shea Whigham is in that movie. You know, like, but I mean, so it's also like, it's like Jody Hill, like Jody Hill, like truly transgressive comedies. If you've never seen The Fist Foot Way or Observe and Report, yeah. Report, you could never Wild. Make that movie.
No, you could not make it today.
No, you couldn't. You couldn't, like the line, like the moment I was like, oh shit, this is fucking wild, is the Anna Faris keep on fucking me, motherfucker. Yeah. Because you're watching it, you're going, oh my God, what are we watching? How the fuck? And then he does that. And I saw that in a packed theater because like it was an early screening with Seth Rogen, where Seth Rogen and Jody Hill showed up with Danny McBride. And you could hear that people wanted to laugh at the line, but knew that they shouldn't laugh at the line. It was wild. Like all three of them, like it's just wild to me. And like if you're not watching this, get on it right away and just literally, I feel like if you start binging it now, by the time like the third or fourth episode will have premiered, you'll be on track to be back online with the Righteous Gemstones. Like it is, like to me, it's like this is like my favorite television show, and I'm truly, truly sad that it's going away. But if this is what we're gonna get, this kind of prelude, if this is the style of what, if this is the level of the storytelling that we're gonna get, but you know, maybe transposed to like the Gemstones of current era, man, I'm buckling up and I'm in store for this. I'm so fucking ready for this. Better to have for me at least, better to land the ending. Because I mean,
to have it drag on and on and on. Yeah.
Exactly. Because I think it was it season two with the like I thought it could have ended on season two, I think. Was the season two ending the one where they did the truck?
Season two, or I think it was season two.
Because season three is them all on the, is all at the, like them taking over the resort.
Yeah.
So yeah, the ending is not only that, but the bomb, right?
Yeah.
They accidentally activate the bomb. Is it Jesse that activates it?
I think so. I need to go back and rewatch them.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to like I said, like as soon as it finishes up, we're going to go ahead and rewatch it. My wife is going to rewatch it with me. So, but I don't know how long it's going to take us, because the thing that I always forget is, like, what they do in 30 minutes is super fucking emotionally exhausting.
Yeah. It's like, oh my God, this show wears me out, man.
Yeah. Does Stephanie watch it, or has she?
I turned her on to it. She's constantly asking me for show recommendations. And so I'm just like, well, here's what I started watching. And so it started back this week, and I was like, well, Vice Principals is back. You've got HBO Max, so you could try that. And I said, watch the first few episodes. If it's not for you, like, don't keep watching, because you're not going to enjoy it more. Like, it's not going to get better. You're just going to be like, oh, it's just more of this. I was like, so if you don't like it by the end of the second episode, it's not going to be for you. And she texted me, and she was like, this is hysterical. I was like, yeah, it's pretty wild.
Now,
my Uncle Baby Billy is hysterical. Yeah.
No, that's what I'm going to ask, because she's a Walton Goggins fan. How does she take to,
She loves it. She loves it. Her and I both have been really, really frustrated with White Lotus, because that's why we started watching, so that we could see what he was going to do in the show. And man, I read the stories. I'm like, there's this episode that just aired. He does something, and while filming, he got bit by a snake and had to be taken to the hospital. And like, I'm watching it going like, this wasn't worth you getting bit by a snake and having to be taken to the hospital, man. Like, I do not know what's going on with that show. It's not terrible. It looks fantastic, but it's so boring. It's nice to have, Righteous Gemstones back, and like, just coming out of the gate with that was just like wild. But I know what we're in for next is the zaniness of the prayer pod thing, which I don't know if you've seen that commercial. That's crazy.
Yes.
I'm so here for it. Sunday nights are just continue to be like, not a ton of TV on, but like, yeah, football's not here, and I'm glad I've got this. So,
absolutely, yeah, happy that it's back. I'm sad that this is our last season, but I'm fairly certain. Like, after this, I'm fairly certain they're gonna land the ending. Whatever the ending is,
yeah,
it's gonna end. It's gonna be perfect, and I'll want to rewatch it again. Because it's just so. It's just so fucking good. Like, and like I said, like, my only hope is that we won't have to wait a long time to get Danny McBride back into something else that he wants to like kind of do, because I mean, he's kind of taken on a lot of things. I mean, he's taken on sports, he's taken on religion, he's taken on school system. So like, the one thing I think about, and it's going to be really fucking scary and uncomfortable, but I feel like this is, like, I'm going to call it right now, it's going to take on politics. I feel like it's next to politics.
It'll be great to see, man.
So,
I don't know what we're going to talk about next week, but I mean, I am on vacation for a week, so I am going to watch so much shit.
That's great. Yeah, we'll figure it out, man. I mean, we'll figure something out.
Get a chance to go see both Looney Tunes and Novocaine, since I'll be off. We'll see.
But okay. Absolutely. I will try to do the same. I have tickets tomorrow to see Novocaine. I might just make it a double feature and go see that, and because it's playing at the same theater as the Looney Tunes movie. I mean, I'm truly hyped for both of them. Jack Quaid, can he become a star? Like, I heard.
Yeah, he's got a lot going on this year too.
Yeah. And I've heard people say that this is a really good, underrated little movie. So, you know, this could turn out to be like his own John Wick, or at the minimum Crank. I was actually going to start watching Crank. I was going to watch the first one. Because, like, I mean, the second one's useless, but the first one's actually pretty fun.
Yeah.
But But yeah, we'll be back next week. What's up?
And well, I was going to say, until then, you can check out everything else we're doing over at xwingfiles.com, or you can check out our written work over at Adam's website.
Yes, themovieowl.com, where I've got a ton of Blu-ray and 4K reviews. I'm actually excited because I just got the 4K of Black Sheep, what's his name? Good Lord, I can't even give his name. Because I haven't seen it in like 20 years. Chris Farley, David Spade movie. They're releasing it for its 35th anniversary or something like that. Makes me feel old. But I'm excited to actually dive into a movie I haven't seen since like my college years. Hopefully it stands the test of time. I don't know. It'll be a little bit scary, but also a little bit of fun. That will be next week. And I've got a bunch of other stuff that's already on the site right now, as is. But you can read that on themovieowl.com if you want to.
No. We'll be back next week. Probably definitely talking about Novocaine. Hopefully we both get a chance to see Looney Tunes. And I'm sure I will have watched a shit ton of TV between now and then. Because I, other than going to see my family this weekend, like I've got a week, literally 7 days where I don't have anything to do. So it's going to be a lot of video game and TV watching. So.
Nice.
So yeah, we will see you guys soon. Number 4 Mario, number 5 Weird Al, number 6 Batman, number 7 Cal, number 8 Simpsons, number 9 TV, number 10 every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but they're really all sold out. Say hello together if you're with me now.